I'm Tofu Steve, and welcome to the episode. This is episode 20 of the Beyond Species podcast. So this is the last episode of season one, and I'm going to take a break for the summer and come back in a few months with season two. I had planned on doing a kind of reflective episode, looking back and drawing the different strands together from the guests that I've spoken to. But I'll probably leave that for season two now. In the last couple of weeks, obviously, we've seen a momentous uprising in terms of Black Lives Matter. So I've decided instead to dedicate this episode to Black voices. I do want to thank all the guests that I've had on this season. I've really appreciated your time, your input, and your honesty. And it's been really encouraging to hear from all of you about the work that's being done across all parts of the world by people who are just everyday people like the rest of us listening. And it's a reminder that we all have the power to begin making changes in our society, and that we need not rely on kind of celebrity influences and should not rely on them to be the change makers. We are the change makers. I also want to let people know who had expressed an interest in being on the show, or who I had contacted but hadn't got round to. I haven't forgotten you, and I look forward to having you on season two. So I will be in touch over the next few months, and we can work out a plan. So I'll move on now to the episode. So I'm not going to do any speaking in this episode, and no introductions or anything like that, or context. I'm just going to play these voices. So I will just give you a list of the people speaking in case you want to look further into them and their work, their activism, and their lives. So the list of people that are about to follow are Akala, Maya Angelou, James Baldwin, George the Poet, Kyla Lacey, Angela Davis, Toni Morrison. And I think this episode is particularly important for white people like myself, to sit down and first of all, listen. And once we've listened, then we need to take action. And it's up to us to do the work. Because, unfortunately, and as uncomfortable as it is, we are the ones who are born into the position of privilege and the position of the oppressor.
All right, sorry.
Nothing.
Akala?
You've got no substance to your argument. You're not even backing up.
You've got loads of substance.
What happened to Lee Rigby? What happened on 7-7? All the Muslim grooming gangs. Everything I say is factual.
Let someone else speak for a minute, please, Tommy.
Of course, Mr. Robinson, there are no paedophiles who are white, and white people have never bombed anyone.
87% of grooming cases are Muslim, yet 5% of the country is Muslim.
You spoke. Yeah. Let me speak. Now, this is exactly the issue, is what I'm saying, right? As much as I agree with what's being said about this man and his organisation, right?
Can you back up,
we focus on fringe bigots rather than dealing with the real central issue that we have a political system. I can't count how many times I've read the Daily Mail or some other paper, not that I read these rags, and it says, Pakistani man does blah. When Jimmy Savile is convicted or something comes out about him, is his ethnicity or his religious beliefs put forward as the primary reason for him committing an offence? No. But we can't. This kind of bigotry, right? And then act shocked when it comes up.
No one's prepared to explain what I said is bigotry. One second.
For those who don't know, Baghdad was the intellectual cultural centre of mathematics and art and science about 1,000 years ago for quite a long time. No one blames Islam for that. So negative people who happen to be Muslim, yes, of course, it's your religion that causes it. But if you pioneer mathematics and science and introduce algebra into Europe and the guitar and coffees and lemons, that's not because you're Muslim.
Well, the people...
Okay. I'm going to get an opposing...
This is exactly what I said at the beginning of the programme. When we deal with racism, rather than dealing with the structural reality and all this nonsense about people are racist because they're frustrated about their life, it's totally classist. Yeah. What we're saying, only working class people are racist. Do me a favour. Racism was not invented by working class people. It was invented by elite academics through pseudoscientific nonsense and perpetuated as part of political policy from the top down, not the bottom up. In fact, if we look back at the history of this country, when there were slave catchers in the streets, people had far more allies in working class parts of London than they did from rich people who were trying to catch them and send them back to the Caribbean. So let's be honest about the history and deal with the bigger problems of structural racism, because then smaller things and smaller frustrations that are breeding this type of nonsense won't be excavated so much. But this is the problem, is we focus on nonsense like this rather than dealing with why a British soldier you've probably never heard of, a gentleman called Christopher Alder, died in 1999 in police custody. There is footage on YouTube that you can see for yourself of him on the floor with his bottom half exposed, with police officers around him making monkey noises over his dead body. You've never heard his name. Why?
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll arise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns with the certainty of tides. Just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my sassiness upset you? Don't take it so hard just because I laugh, as if I have gold mines digging in my own backyard. You can shoot me with your words. You can cut me with your lies. You can kill me with your hatefulness. But just like life, I rise. Does my sexiness offend you? Oh. Does it come as a surprise that I dance? As if I have diamonds at the meeting of my thighs. Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling and bearing in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, wow. There I go.
Is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people and our representatives. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they are going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need him. The question you've got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, north and south, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there is no difference in the north and the south. There's just a difference in the way they, in a way they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you got to find out why.
Yo, my name's George the Poet. Despite black males being overrepresented at every level of the criminal justice system, despite black people being 40 times more likely to be stopped and searched, despite black and minority ethnic groups being twice as likely to die in police custody, many people in our country are unaware that we have a problem. The Black Lives Matter movement is sadly more relevant than ever. Thank you to LDM, BLM and Revolt for taking this time to revisit episode 4 of Have You Heard George's podcast, It's On Us. Old friends become young friends when they're older than you, but they die at a young age. Even though you're getting older, their youth is immortalized on a front page. Some of them follow me around, reminding me that one day I ain't gonna be around. And when that day comes, I'm gonna wanna be around, 'cause currently we're down. This is not an opinion, it's a statement of fact. 12% of the prison population is black, and only 3% of the whole population is black. I'm passionate about changing the stats, so I'm gonna make an impact. But when you fight to take control and try to break the mold, despite an aching soul, over time it takes a toll. I'm not okay. Certain days I ain't got no faith. But yo, I'm the artist, George the poet. If I'm not feeling confident, I can't afford to show it. If police really got to, man, I can't afford to show it. I'm supposed to do that thing when I half talk and flow it. Endorse the moment, I'm forced to own it. Record a poem, explore the whole thing. Grab the curtains and pull them open. What's all this sulking? You got this whole place to yourself, you know. Like a 12-year-old Macaulay Culkin. Nah, man, you ain't been depressed. Stop claiming you're stressed and ignore that little pain in your chest. It's a minor. Look at Anthony, he's a lifer. Does he phone you up and cry, cuz? He'll be alright, cuz. Then I notice the music's gone. But at the same time, the news is on. The same social media I take for granted, the government tried to tax that. It's looking kind of slapdash and now they're facing backlash. I hate seeing people have to fight for their freedoms, but at least it's not a racial war. And that's a mad thing to be grateful for. But I've got friends that have only ever been told they're black and never saw themselves any other way before.
What they put in front of me and what knowledge they feed me, but I don't really know what I go on in Africa. That shit's lost. I can't tell you my surname. You know what I'm saying? I can't tell you what tribe or family I've got. Man's lost. So when you see kids out here moving like they're lost, why are people surprised that they're lost?
That's my brethren Deezy talking about displacement. Talking about feeling awkward and out of place in a land you were raised on, and in a land where your ancestors came from. Why is it so lonely being black when there's bare of us? How can we be so powerless when we know for a fact that they're scared of us?
Their title is, I would ask them, when they see or hear about another black person, child, being stabbed, shot, murdered, or imprisoned in these streets, I want to know how it affects them, not how it makes them feel, because everyone's going to say, oh, it makes me feel sad, I don't want this for my country, I don't want this for the situation. No, how does it affect you? How does it affect your community? How does it affect your family structure? You know what I'm saying? Because I've lost family to the roads and I watched my living room break down.
I remember at 13, my brother got stabbed. And that was, I can categorically say, that was the moment that every single one of us lost our innocence. But then we go back to school on Monday morning. Do you know what I mean? Mm. There's no counselling, there's no, nobody's thinking, how does that affect these young black children to have a brother literally taken away from them?
Imagine a whole Jamelia. Sometimes I think nowadays the roads is greasier, but that happened before drill music and social media. See, there's a trauma that I can't put into words, but when you hear it from a successful black woman like her, it makes getting that point across so much easier. It's mad though. Jamelia.
This is it, but nobody acknowledged these are hurt boys. These are damaged boys, these are pressurized boys, and they, you know, they don't have a sense of self in the world because they're going to school and the teachers don't like them. The police on the road, I remember once going bike riding with my brothers, I was such a tomboy when I was little, going on a bike ride with my brothers, and the police stopped us on bikes, you know. So just imagine stopping us on bikes and asking us, particularly the boys, Where did you get these bikes from? Who were these bikes? It was their bikes. And to me, that was the beginning of stop and search. So by the time you get to stop and search, you got a terrible relationship with the police.
The fact that we actually have the capacity to speak out and not just take this passively, that makes a lot of people angry. They can't stand the audacity. Our story makes a lot of eyes roll in irritation. We're accused of downplaying our role in this equation. We're told that we're always self-imposing limitations, and if our attitude was right, there would be no discrimination. We're told that it's because our homes are broken and they're failing. We're told that this is old and this is draining. We're told to quit complaining. Quit complaining. Why isn't this known as victim blaming? It's the same thing. Victim blaming is a term for situations in which the main thing focused on isn't just the crime, but the victim's actions and decisions at the time. There's two sides to every story, but you want to hear theirs first before listening to mine, and you know why. Some people can do no wrong. Others can do no right.
With breaking news and in the latest developments regarding the riots in London and throughout cities in the country, the Prime Minister has
promised to increase the number of police on London streets tonight by 10,000 in the wake of the third night of rioting.
I couldn't rate the riots of 2011, but I was praying for Mark Duggan's entry to heaven. Most of them, man, they was cowards to me. I'm thinking, why don't you lot take this to the powers that be? You lot ain't running up on no police stations, cause you lot ain't trying to have it out with police. I wanna see you all maintaining this energy. Once Mark's body is laying in the cemetery, when you're sitting on remand in a state penitentiary. Everyone's reaction was different, that was mine. I was pissed off at the time. Pissed off that people's hearts were hardened now. Pissed off that Mark's family were targets now. Pissed his killers were defo getting pardons now. And pissed off at how that woman disrespected Dark as hell about Marcus Dow.
Marcus Dow, are you shocked by what you've seen there last night?
No, not at all.
You say you're not shocked. Does this mean that you condone what happened in your community last night?
Of course not. There is a young man called Mark Duggan. He has parents, he has brothers, he has sisters, and a police officer blew his head off.
A man was killed and his family was ignored. Just like my family were ignored that night. No effort was made to present the facts right, and despite any attempts to gaslight, we can't pretend that that's right. Mark was in the back of a taxi. Apparently there was a box with a strap in the back seat. Police stopped the car and according to the driver, Mark started running for his life, but two shots caught him. One arm, one chest. And now the unanswered question is, why were shots fired at an unarmed suspect if a shot wasn't bust yet? Initial reports said Mark fired a gun, implying this was why he was trying to run. No word to the family for a day and a half, but that's not the headline once a riot's begun. One of the officers said they saw Mark pull a pistol from his waistband, implying that's the reason for the fate that he suffered, but he never touched the gun, as it was later discovered. The officer that said this furthermore never mentioned it in his first report. The irony is, police always say it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something you later rely on in court. I.e., your story looks shaky if you miss out the important bits once you've been caught. Food for thought. See, I'm trying to explain the demonstrations of resistance. Three of the officers said they saw a colleague throw this gun away into the distance. These statements were later rescinded. This kind of behaviour explains the widespread intergenerational police hatred in England. An officer was injured. The Independent Police Complaints Commission released a statement in which, the police later claimed, mistakes were written. Given the sensitivity and the intensity around these events, it seems that wasn't a great decision. They claimed the officer was shot before Mark, but that's not at all possible, Doug. Because here's the illogical part. The bullet came from a police gun and got stuck in the officer's radio after passing through Mark's arm. That's why the community's looking at you, police, and asking you wagwan. Turns out there was no evidence the gun was fired. Makes you lot look like a bunch of liars. This reflects the disregard and disrespect that characterised the London riots.
We learned your French. We learned your English, your Dutch, your Spanish, your Portuguese. You learned our nothing. You called us stupid. That's white privilege. And I'm sure it probably hurts for you to hear those two words, kind of like gunshots and explosions from those commissioned to protect you, whisking past your ears. What is white privilege? It is the only 5 decades of legal acknowledgement expected to correct 400 years of white transgression. It is crack versus cocaine. Blacks receiving almost 20% longer sentences for the same exact offenses. So like, for instance, a black man without a record is less likely to get a job than a white felon. Well, maybe it's because we're lazy and we don't work hard enough. Like, what the fuck? 400 years in the same field literally is an incredible resume builder. It is Katrina answering the government's prayers of eugenics, Dick Cheney going fishing the next day, Condoleezza on a shopping spree, Bush in San Diego, but Kanye is the one you call crazy because, like, it only took the USA 2 days to get aid to Asia, but 5 for FEMA to get to Canal Street, and Esplanade is the one black kid who beat the shit out of the odds, but only thanks to Michelle Pfeiffer and the White Shadow and Sandra Bullock, so now we all can make it. It is the only time thousands of white people are cheering for a black kid to win. Is it a stadium? It is you looking at me crazy if I told you to go back to Europe even though we didn't have a say, and your great-grandparents came here voluntarily. It is you all of a sudden having a problem with immigration, like this isn't even your nation. How the hell do you discover some shit that wasn't even missing to begin with? You Columbus our traditions. Got white girls twerking in high definition with multicolored nails and purple hair, but it was ghetto when we did it. Oh, am I making you uncomfortable? Try a cramped slave ship. Oh, wait. Slavery is over now. It's just called the prison system, because, like, you're not racist because you don't use the N-word, but y'all use niggas every day. What is white privilege? It is the acceptance of bombs over Baghdad, but not over Boston. It is European history being taught as a major and African as an elective. It is learning about my people only 28 days. Like, I'm not black every fucking second. It is every white boy who want to fuck my brains out, not because I'm pretty, but because I'm pretty for a black girl. It is people thinking that Africa is one nation. It is the waving of the Confederate flag like you didn't lose the battle and telling us to get over slavery. It is people saying that black people destroy neighborhoods but forgetting that white people destroy continents. It is every time I have to bring up my plight, some white man is telling me that I'm crazy but is kind enough to praise my English or say that we are all given the same opportunities when he has a family history of wealth and I don't even know my family history at all. It is the justification of police brutality, like what that person do? Well, I'm sure it doesn't hurt as much when the victim doesn't look like you and is throwing out a qualified applicant because their name sounded too African American. Is Newports imported into black communities but black boys exported for weed? It is big plastic asses called fat when we naturally have them. It is an Australian woman whose new classic of rap music. It is everyone who hears this poem dismisses all this truth I just spit. That is white privilege.
Well, for more on this historic moment, we are spending the hour with the legendary activist and scholar Angela Davis, professor emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz. For half a century, Angela Davis has been one of the most influential activists and intellectuals in the United States, an icon of the Black Liberation Movement. Angela Davis's work around issues of gender, race, class, and prisons has influenced critical thought and social movements across several generations. She's a leading advocate for prison abolition, a position informed by her own experience as a prisoner and a fugitive on the FBI's top 10 wanted list more than 40 years ago. Once caught, she faced the death penalty in California. After being acquitted on all charges, she spent her life fighting to change the criminal justice system. Angela Davis, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us today for the hour.
Thank you very much, Amy. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, do you think this moment is a tipping point, a turning point? You who have been involved in activism for almost half a century, do you see this moment as different, perhaps more different than any period of time you have lived through?
Absolutely. This is an extraordinary moment. I've never experienced anything like the conditions we are currently experiencing. The conjuncture created by the COVID-19 pandemic and the recognition of the systemic racism that has been rendered visible under these conditions because of the disproportionate deaths in Black and Latinx communities. And this is a moment I don't know whether I ever expected to experience. When the protests began, of course, around the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and Tony McDade and many others who've lost their lives to racist state violence and vigilante violence, When these protests erupted, I remembered something that I've said many times to encourage activists who often feel that the work that they do is not leading to tangible results. I often ask them to consider the very long trajectory of Black struggles, and what has been most important is the forging of legacies and new arenas of struggle that can be handed down to younger generations. But I've often said one never knows when conditions may give rise to a conjuncture such as the current one that rapidly shifts popular consciousness and suddenly allows us to move in the direction of radical change. If one does not engage in the ongoing work, when such a moment arises, we cannot take advantage of the opportunities to change. And of course, this moment will pass. The intensity of the current demonstrations cannot be sustained over time, but we will have to be ready to shift gears and address these issues in different arenas, including, of course, the electoral arena.
Angela Davis, you've long been a leader of the critical resistance movement, the abolition movement. And I'm wondering if you can explain the demand as you see it, what you feel needs to be done around defunding the police and then around prison abolition.
Well, the call to defund the police is, I think, an abolitionist demand. But it reflects only one aspect of the process represented by the demand. Defunding the police is not simply about withdrawing funding for law enforcement and doing nothing else. And it appears as if this is the rather superficial understanding that has caused Biden to move in the direction he's moving in. It's about shifting public funds to new services and new institutions, mental health counselors who can respond to people who are in crisis without arms. It's about shifting funding to education, to housing, to recreation. All of these things help to create security and safety. It's about learning that safety, safeguarded by violence, is not really safety. And I would say that abolition is not primarily a negative strategy. It's not primarily about dismantling, getting rid of, but it's about re-envisioning. It's about building anew. And I would argue that abolition is a feminist strategy, and one sees in these abolitionist demands that are emerging the pivotal influence of feminist theories and practices.
Explain that further.
Well, I want us to see feminism not only as addressing issues of gender, but rather as a methodological approach of understanding the intersectionality of struggles and issues. Abolition feminism counters carceral feminism, which has unfortunately assume that issues such as violence against women can be effectively addressed by using police force, by using imprisonment as a solution. And of course, we know that Joseph Biden in 1994, who claims that the Violence Against Women Act was such an important moment in his career, the Violence Against Women Act was couched within the 1994 Crime Act, the Clinton Crime Act. And what we're calling for is a process of decriminalization, not a recognizing that that threats to safety, threats to security come not primarily from what is defined as crime, but rather from the failure of institutions in our country to address issues of health, issues of violence, education, et cetera. So abolition is really about rethinking the kind of future we want, the social future, the economic future, the political future. It's about revolution, I would argue.
You write in Freedom is a Constant Struggle, neoliberal ideology drives us to focus on individuals, ourselves, individual victims, individual perpetrators. But how is it possible to solve the massive problem of racist state violence by calling upon individual police officers to bear the burden of that history and to assume that by prosecuting them, by exacting our revenge on them, we would have somehow made progress in eradicating racism? So explain what exactly you're demanding.
Well, neoliberal logic assumes that the fundamental unit of society is the individual, and I would say the abstract individual. According to that logic, Black people can combat racism by pulling themselves up by their own individual bootstraps. That logic recognizes, or fails rather, to recognize that there are institutional barriers that cannot be brought down by individual determination. If a Black person is materially unable to attend the university, the solution is not affirmative action, they argue, but rather the person simply needs to work harder, get good grades, and do what is necessary in order to acquire the funds to pay for tuition. Neoliberal logic deters us from thinking about the simpler solution, which is free education. I'm thinking about the fact that we have been aware of the need for these institutional strategies at least since 1935, and of course before, but I'm choosing 1935 because that was the year when W.E.B. Du Bois published his germinal Black Reconstruction in America. And the question was not, what should individual Black people do, but rather how to reorganize and restructure post-slavery society in order to guarantee the incorporation of those who had been formerly enslaved. The society could not remain the same, or should not have remained the same. Neoliberalism resists change at the individual level. It asks the individual to adapt to conditions of capitalism, to conditions of racism.
Arthur Ashe was here, the late Arthur Ashe.
Yes.
And he said to me, as he said in one other place, he said, in a much quoted comment, he said, living with AIDS is easier than living with racism. It's a harder struggle against racism for me than it is against AIDS. Mm. What it meant to me is that there's no way for the rest of us to understand that daily encounter. Which brings me to my question to you. Do you still have that encounter? Do you, Toni Morrison, Pulitzer Prize winner, successful, honored in the halls of academe, etc., still have that encounter?
Yes, I do, Charlie, but let me tell you, that's the wrong question.
Okay, what's the right question?
How do you feel? Not you, Charlie Rose,
right.
But don't you understand that the people who do this thing, who practice racism,
right,
are bereft? There is something distorted about the psyche. It's a huge waste, and it's a corruption and a distortion. It's a profound neurosis that nobody examines for what it is. It feels crazy. It is crazy. And it has just as much of a deleterious effect on white people, and possibly equal, as it does Black people. I always knew that I had the moral high ground all my life. I always thought those people who said I couldn't come in the drugstore and I had to sit in these funny places, I couldn't
go
in the park.
You felt moral superior to them
from day
one.
And I thought they knew that I knew that they were inferior to me morally. I always thought that. And my parents always thought that.
You said your father was racist because he always felt like he was superior.
That's right. He always felt superior. And that was a form, you know, of defensive racism. But if the racist white person, I don't mean the person who is examining his consciousness and so on, doesn't understand that he or she is also a race, it's also constructed, it's also made, and it also has some kind of serviceability. But when you take it away, I take your race away, and there you are, all strung out, and all you got is your little self. And what is that? What are you without racism? Are you any good? Are you still strong? You still smart? You still like yourself? I mean, these are the questions. It's part of it is, yes, the victim, how terrible it has been for black people.
You don't like that.
I'm not a victim. I refuse to be one.
And the victim is the other person who is morally inferior. And
that's
what.
That's a serious question.
To
of course,
racism.
If you have
to
hold,
for his or her own self-esteem and definition.
If you can only be tall, because somebody's on their knees, then you have a serious problem. And my feeling is, white people have a very, very serious problem, and they should start thinking about what they can do about it. Take me out of it.
Black lives matter!